Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars. Everyone, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars,
the show that takes you through every Best Picture nominee from 1927 to today.
I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Ryan, and we crushed it.
It was so good. I got chills.
It feels so good. I don't want to start off on a bad note, but I do want to make sure that we go ahead and get this right out of the gate. Kyle, where were you the night of 1929?
I was at the theater seeing the hit film Alibi, starring Chester Morris, Harry Stubbs, Mae Bush, and Eleanor Griffith.
Does the person that you're with have the perfect excuse and proof of two ticket stubs to that showing?
I went alone, so I feel like I'm in danger.
Not a good look.
Nobody wanted to go see this movie with me. It's not my fault, man.
Well, you know what? This is why you always need an alibi.
You're right. And I'll have one for next time.
We have one today.
We do. We had to watch this movie because it's the movie we're talking about.
This is our fourth. We'll get there.
Yeah.
Our fourth nominee that we've talked about for this year's Academy Awards for the 1930 Academy Award ceremony. So, Alibi.
Yeah.
Alibi was an interesting one. You know, we've had our, well, The Patriot that we couldn't watch, famously. Talked about Lost Media. We had In Old Arizona, our Western that was truly set outdoors and filmed outdoors.
Yeehaw.
Yeehaw indeed. And then we had our musical, our first talking musical in the Broadway Melody that we talked about. We'll do one, only one this time.
Says you.
It says me. And now we have The Racket 2.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've got a gangster movie for sure.
Yeah.
Although, as I say that, I almost want to call it a crime movie instead. I don't know if there's a huge distinction, but it didn't feel like your typical, like, Muggsy, as we said earlier with The Racket, that type of gangster movie.
Well, it was missing the Nick Scarcy of it all, right? From The Racket, sure. Like, that was a movie that was really hinging on the performance of that Nick Scarcy character, and this is more just crime in general. There's not really one, like, figurehead of the crime that's happening. It's more just a criminal in place of it.
Yeah, and that criminal being the closest thing to the head, at least who you're following, doesn't have anywhere near the same charisma that Lewis Wolheim presented in Nick Scarcy.
Correct.
But we're kind of getting right into the nitty-gritty with this one.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Let's talk about the movie itself. So Alibi had a couple names that it was known by, right? The Perfect Alibi or Nightstick, but most commonly it's known as Alibi. It was directed by Roland West. 1929, it is, to your earlier point, a crime film. And it was starring Chester Morris and Mae Bush.
Mae Bush being a huge silent film star.
Really?
Yes. I have not seen her in anything, but she was a big, big name.
So was this one of the first examples of someone coming and transitioning from silent film to talkie specifically? Like a well-known actor of the time?
It might be, as far as like a silent star name that would bring in the crowds.
Yes.
Could very well be.
Interesting.
Yeah. That being said, she's not really a highlight in this movie.
She's not.
A name you didn't bring up, I didn't bring up either in our little gag at the beginning, is Regis Toomey.
Oh, the only reason I had silence is I was going to make a joke about Regis Toomey.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, that's fine. Go ahead.
We locked eyes like we were both waiting for the other one.
So there's a couple of people, right? Like the main cast here being Chester Morris, Eleanor Griffith is a very big part of it. Regis Toomey, to your point, and Mae Bush.
And Harry Stubbs.
And Harry Stubbs.
Yes.
Great name.
I like it.
Yeah.
But
very descriptive.
Yeah. All of these names, I mean, really the big names on the poster and everything are going to be Chester Morris as your lead villain gangster and Mae Bush. That being said, Regis Toomey really is kind of the highlight of this movie, I think. Whether you like his performance or not, he's putting on the biggest spectacle. And let's get into the characters.
So in our cast, we have Chester Morris, who does play Chick Williams, the titular criminal that you mentioned earlier. Eleanor Griffith is his love interest. She's very much head over heels when we first meet her, and she's very excited to marry him, much to the displeasure of her father, the police sergeant Pete Manning, played by Pernell Pratt. Mae Bush is in it as well as Daisy Thomas, and you mentioned Regis Toomey, who does play Danny McGann, but also Billy Morgan. There's a reason for that name difference there that we'll get into in a little bit here. So the main play characters that we need to know about is Chick Williams. We see his relationship with Joan, and we see that much to the displeasure of her her father, who is very much adamant of proving that this is a bad idea, right? Mm-hmm. Police sergeant, he knows that Chick, I mean, very beginning of the movie, Chick is coming out of prison. And like, this is like, hey, he's different. He's fine now. Don't worry about it. And the police sergeant, her father, is just like, this is just not going to happen. But guess what? It happens. And movie begins. And that's the movie from there. The central plot of this movie is that there is a murder that happens of a police officer, right? There's a robbery that's happening of seemingly fur coats.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So fur coats are being stolen. A police officer stops it. There's a scene that I actually really like that isn't like, I don't think they invented this. I think this is just what they did back then. Everyone had like the billy clubs and they would start banging it on the loudest thing they could find and using that as like essentially a police siren to notify other police officers that something was happening. Mm-hmm. So I kind of liked that scene a lot of how he started notifying people and he had them cornered. But then someone just, you see a hand come out and shoot the police officer. He dies, and then everyone gets away, and they find this police officer. Chick Williams is the first person that they come to and say, well, hey, we need to know where you were, because we suspect that you were the one to kill this man. And he says, at the very beginning, actually a little suspicious of close to what you said at the beginning of the episode of where you were, that he was at the theater with Joan, so he couldn't have done it. And Joan even has the ticket stubs to prove, yeah, this is where we were. So this is his alibi, so to speak.
Right.
And that's the central part of this point of this movie is he has the proof of why he wasn't there. So how could it be him?
Right.
And the movie continues with you wondering, well, then who really did this? How could this have happened if he really was at that location? So before we get any further, I want to point out something that happens in the very beginning of the movie. There's an opening sequence. And I remember I texted you this and I can't remember the exact phrase that I said, but there is something about how haunting the opening sequences.
Right, yeah.
And not just one shot, but, you know, we're in the prison, and after the title card shows up, there's a guard who's standing outside of these prison cells, and he, I think, blows a whistle, and then these doors open, and all you see is the doors. And then the doors, almost not even close, retract. And as they retract, it shows all of the prisoners standing there. And it just feels very, like, scary and haunting and dark. And then once all the prisoners are walking, one of the guards pulls Chick aside and tells him to like go to like the mail room to pick something up. So then we cut to Chick in the mail room, and it's this extremely wide shot, right? It's a large room, almost like a warehouse that's just for the mail room. And it's Chick talking to someone else. You can barely hear what he's actually saying. And they're exchanging, you know, a package. There's like a change of clothes and a card and everything. And that opening sequence of that hallway and then that large room, I remember telling you, like, this is like horror movie stuff. Like, there, it's very disarming is how it feels. And there's no music to accompany it that makes it feel kind of like, you know, hey, this is a little brighter than you think it is right now. And we're playing this a little more mysterious and mischievously.
Yeah.
No, it's just like kind of just haunting. It's just that image. You hear the clacking, you hear people moving. Like, it's a decision to be made, which is interesting because the rest of this movie is a thriller, but isn't really that scary or like that haunting. And I can't stop thinking about that opening image. Like, that to me was the best part of the movie because it felt audacious and something they didn't have to do. How did it affect you?
So it's really interesting. It did feel a lot like a horror movie. Like you said, it felt very reminiscent of something like Nosferatu,
yeah,
or The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. There's a lot of German expressionism in this with really harsh angles and things, and wide open spaces, a lot of playing with shadows and light, which is so cool to see in a black and white film. We talked about it last episode, the unique uses of sound other than just speech and dialogue, banging on the prison cells and things, and the ticking of the clock and all of that, and the lack of music in what should easily be a, oh, we'll just throw in music because now we can do that. But choosing to use sound effects adds to just that really harsh atmosphere that's created in the opening of the movie. The opening of this movie might be my favorite thing that we'll watch all this Academy season.
I mean, I only have one more to go, right?
Yeah.
But like, it's easily the highlight of mine. I think that we have existed in a time period this year where we're watching a lot of, you know, we're trying to figure this out, right?
Yeah.
We got this new technology, bear with us, we're figuring it out. And we're kind of giving like kudos to it, right? I think there's, to your point, some great shots in old Arizona of like them running. There isn't a shot specifically, but it's just like the idea of being able to capture this. Mm-hmm. That looks great. So imagine my surprise when Alibi comes around and they're not even experimenting with something. They're just kind of like going for it.
Right.
Right? Like two shots like back to back. And those shots really aren't seen. You might be able to make the argument that the robbery scene where the police officer is shot, there's some in that, but I think it's more the way they play with shadow. And I really like the way they play with shadow, but just that opening sequence to me, you hit it like nail on the head, like with the German expressionist side. Like it's very like, there's a lot of space. We want you to look around. We don't want you to just be focused on one thing. The black and white element lends itself to it very heavily because it adds that level of darkness quite literally in the mm-hmm. shadows. So it prepared me for something that I was just not ready for.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a spoiler to say that it doesn't really continue beyond that. The tone of the movie itself doesn't really lend itself to those opening shots, in my opinion.
That's true. The way it does feel oppressive and like a horror movie, even though it's so spacious in those opening shots.
Yeah.
That tone kind of goes away. But I don't think that the blocking and your angles and things disappear completely.
True.
It's just presenting a different atmosphere later on.
Yes. I think that whoever was doing set design for the prison popped off.
Oh, let's talk about that real quick.
Yeah.
The nominations for this movie, of course, it has Outstanding Picture, Best Actor for Chester Morris, which we'll talk about in a moment. But the art direction, the nominee there is William Cameron Menzies.
My guy, Menzies.
That is a name that's going to pop up many, many times as we cover
Menzies time.
Exactly. I like it. That's good. He was nominated for 6 Academy Awards throughout the course of his career. Spoiler alert, he receives an honorary Oscar for his work on Gone with the Wind eventually. So, I mean, this is arguably one of the biggest names that we will talk about up to this point on the show. And like you're saying, the prison scene and everything as far as the set designs and not just like your practical sets that appear later on in like the club scenes and things, but the end of this movie, when you're on the rooftops and the paintings of the skyline in the background, they don't look real per se, but they're done in a way that I think adds to this overall feel of the film.
There's a scene right after that too, at the very end, where someone's jumping a building, right? And then you see in between the buildings, we're kind of in an overhead shot, and you see between the two buildings, and it's clearly a painting, mm-hmm. right? Something they've drawn. And you're right, you can depict that, like you can detect that it is not actually between two buildings, but there is still that little bit of you that kind of like your breath is taken away just a little bit when someone like slips,
right?
Where it's like, oh, you're gonna fall down there. So I agree, the art direction was like doing some incredible work on this, so all credit to Menzies for that. It's very exciting to kind of like be able to identify these scenarios where the camera, the cinematography and the art design work so well together, and then find out, well, there's icons.
Yeah.
These are icons in the beginning.
I think it's really cool too that the director, Roland West, wasn't nominated for this, and while obviously he's doing some great work and saying, you know, this is the shot I want here and this is the shot I want there, you could not capture more than half of these shots if it wasn't for the art decoration and the set designs.
100%.
So I think it is very, very accurate that the Academy would nominate William Cameron Menzies and maybe not Roland West. And that might have to do with, I don't know, the overall plot line. Well, no, the plot's not bad in this movie, and the performances aren't bad. I just really like the art direction.
Yeah. There's a lot of good in it, right? I think that it set me up for the word that I'm looking for, false expectations of what to expect from the last movie when that's the opening.
Yeah.
Right? So what continues is the story that we mentioned. We'll pick back up with Chick being accused of this crime and him having the alibi of why he couldn't be there. What's done shortly after is they want to make sure they have an informant in on Chick's side. So they bring in a specific officer of theirs that's going to be Danny McGann. Mm-hmm. I believe Danny McGann is actually his name to Chick, and Billy Morgan is his name to the police department.
Police.
Because we hear Danny McGann way more than we hear Billy Morgan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Danny is actually a pretty great bit of casting because Regis Toomey plays Danny as this alcoholic. Like, yes. He's just kind of there. He just happens to be here. In the very beginning, he has a moment with Joan where he tries to, like, talk to her about a magic trick. And the magic trick is that he just happens to get her address. And now he knows where she resides.
Right.
Which, you're arrested. Like, in 2025, if you try that, you're under arrest.
Right.
Insane thing that happened. And the police sergeant, that was one of my favorite scenes. When he says that, and he's like, just wanted to see where you reside, the police sergeant's almost kind of like, ha, got her.
Right.
It's like, do something. Like, what is, anyways. So he kind of like makes himself the fool, and he very much is playing the fool and finds himself into Chick's group. And maybe Chick feels bad for him. We don't fully know, but like he just lets him in there because he's so unassuming.
Yeah.
And that's the perfect bit of like casting for me, or at least the best role that I saw, was the duality that Regis got to play as Danny. And the other character's name I already forgot. Morgan?
Billy.
Billy
some.
So Billy and
Danny.
Danny. I got one name at a time and that's it. So Billy and Danny, and the duality of those two characters, I thought was really, really well done.
Yes.
And I loved that. In a movie that otherwise was kind of filled with the, even if it's not technically a gangster movie, the mob mentality of like, you know, listen here, see, like that caricature of it.
Yep.
Danny was a nice bit of like a bright spot of, hey, there are plenty of alcoholics in this, but I know what you're doing and yeah. I see what you're doing. I thought he played that really well.
It's such a unique performance that not just like that character and like playing a drunk we haven't seen before, but
mm-hmm.
a really...
The duality of it.
The duality, yeah. Complex performance is what I'm thinking. Because the only other kind of drunk performance we've had was in Wings.
Oh, yeah.
That turned into a whole Bubbles thing.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, played for laughs and very funny. And because this is a talking picture, you go from a silent film portraying a drunk kind of is stumbling every once in a while and probably like hiccuping in an intertitle card. And there's none of that with Regis Toomey's performance. He is slurring his words in a way that's, you almost get like a little annoyed because you're like, man, he is hamming it up.
Yeah.
But I think he's so smarmy and slimy as this drunk gangster that when he does shift back into
Billy,
it catches you off guard and you're like, oh wow, that's fantastic the way he's doing both.
Yeah. It's great too, because I think it's the, you kind of have to have that little bit of sliminess because Chick isn't the like dumb criminal.
Yes.
Right. So he wants to make sure that whoever he's bringing in isn't just some like, you know, liability, but he is actually kind of like a sleazy guy. So when Danny plays himself as like, you know, yeah, I'm drunk and I don't know any better, but also I'm kind of a little bit sleazy here with how I got phone numbers and stuff.
Yeah.
That makes Chick feel like he can trust him a little bit more. So all of that is done very well. I gotta say that's probably where the most of my praise ends of the movie.
Okay.
To me, it feels like it goes on a little long. Mm-hmm. The relationship between Joan and Chick feels very depending on the scene. Like Chick's feelings towards Joan really does depend on the scene itself. This is also an example where in the same year where I feel like Broadway Melody did a pretty great job of having, you know, a microphone that was going to be pretty central to where everyone could be in one room and speak and hear pretty well. There's a number of occasions where people are standing like just off center of where the microphone should be and you really can't hear them, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And thank God for closed captionings. But in this case, that wasn't really a thing back then. And when YouTube is trying to put closed captionings on it now, it can only use captionings based on what it hears. And it doesn't hear that well because it's not captured that well on microphone.
Yeah.
To a point where it's almost like there's points that aren't even on microphone where people are speaking. So it's difficult because this is a movie where you need to know everyone and what they're saying. And it's lost. So I didn't have a great experience with the rest of it, which was a shame because it looked incredible.
Yes.
And to your point, when they have like when they're inside buildings, they're finding the best angles of those. But it's really when the art direction is allowed to go off, the set direction is allowed to really go and explore and have these scenarios like these outdoor robberies at night or these prisons with like, I still don't understand why the mail room is that big, but a mail room that's the size of a Costco. Like that is when the movie really excelled to me. But I will say that there is a scene later on towards the end where the confrontation between Danny and Chick that I thought was pretty harrowing and thrilling. That really got me back into it. So overall, we'll get more into the movie, but overall, how did you feel about your return visit to Alibi?
It's so funny. I mentioned Broadway Melody and how I liked it so much less on a rewatch this time. I felt the exact opposite on my rewatch of Alibi. It's gorgeous. It's the best looking movie that we've watched, maybe up to this point.
That's
in
true.
The show. Roland West is doing stuff, and again, credit to William Cameron Menzies. They're just getting creative behind the camera, and it's so effective, and I love all of that. And I think that the story itself is engaging enough. Again, it is hard to tell what's going on at times, so I can't discredit that complaint. But I had a lot of fun watching this. Yeah, I don't know. It kept me engaged in a way that I don't think it did the first time. So overall, I'm a fan of Alibi.
I think I am too.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about this on the last episode, but for me, it's less so, is this movie trying to insult my intelligence and more, did I have a good time?
Right.
Right. Yeah. So I'm not going to rate it like, hey, I thought it was kind of boring. There's one star. Like, I'm going to give it its credit where it's due, for sure. But this one specifically just did not sit with me as well as the others have.
Yeah.
Despite me liking some aspects of it better than the other movies. It felt like it didn't fully handle the Chick and Joan of it all a little bit. I would have wanted to see a little bit more of them proper to feel like that's actually a thing. Because the way we're introduced to them is like Chick is out of prison and Joan is just like, yeah, that's my guy. I'm like, well, hold on. Like, how did he become your guy? Like, why is he your guy? Show me like you guys out on the town, like something that establishes you too. So I can fall back on this and not just the whole daddy doesn't want me to like be with you thing.
Yeah. It's really interesting too, because at any point were you under the impression that, oh, Chick is actually a good guy. Maybe he was wrongfully in prison kind of thing. Or right from the get go, was your impression of Chick that he is a bad guy?
It was kind of half and half. Half and half in the sense that my impression from the get-go with that opening scene and the guard pulling him in and then him going to that large room and putting on a suit and everything, I was like, okay, well, he was in prison. Like, I need to know a little bit more about why he was in prison before I start doing this. But then the movie wants you to think that he's okay.
Yes.
The movie wants you to think that he is capable of change and things can get better. But I never was fully convinced of that. Because I was always remembering, maybe because that shot was so like captivating and haunting, that I'm not like, if it was shot differently and we're like more close-ups on him looking like mournful and like, you know, remorseful that he was in this situation, maybe we'd be able to piece together like, okay, well, he didn't want to be here, like he's a good guy. But because that shot specifically of him picking up his belongings was so haunting, you're uneasy. So then anything involving that actor who was in that scene makes you feel uneasy. So for the whole time, I was just like, oh, no, there's something up with you, dog.
And I think that's almost perfect. That's what the movie is kind of pushing you to feel. Because while he does seem like a nice guy when you're first introduced to him and Joan, he does have this complete character shift, almost on the same level, at least from a character standpoint, as Regis Toomey's character, just not as showboaty in a way.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Chester Morris in general.
Yeah.
Because he was nominated for Best Actor in this movie. And do you personally feel like his performance was deserving of that nomination?
I thought he was capital F fine.
Yes.
Not bad, but he was certainly there.
Yeah. He goes on in his career to kind of live in this gangster role. And I think he plays it well. And this might be me looking back from 2025 and all of that. It's such a stereotypical character. You get into that, oh, well, we've seen it before, we've seen a better kind of thing. So while he does a good job, having Regis Toomey's performance in this, it's hard to sing praises for Chester. He's a good gangster. He's just not my favorite gangster.
Yeah. I mean, I think that he is extremely handsome, and I think he plays that part very well. Mm-hmm. That's why you can't really blame Joan too much when she's like, no, that's my guy. It's like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
A dude named Chick, though, that's, to me, that's like Cars. I think of, like, I forget the Cars character's name is Chick, but I'm just going to always think of that character.
Yeah.
And I just don't really think of that as, like, an attractive character to me.
Hmm.
So hearing his name is Chick, I was just like, that's... Because this is, like, seemingly set around Chicago, right? Yeah. So, like, that's Chick to me sounds like a very Southern name. So I'm just... I have questions for Chick, the character.
Now, why don't you have a problem with Chico?
I think I did have a problem with Chico.
Oh, did you? Oh, never mind.
So I think at the time I was like, oh, that's interesting. Let's get back to that. And then he just kept talking about being
a remarkable fellow.
And I was like, okay, yeah, Chico, I'm going to keep you to the sideline right now. Oh, okay. You try to get me. You're not going to get me on that one.
Oops.
You'll get me on something else. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just always kind of under the impression that he was not a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he was trying to do better or not, that was the question. But I thought that he did really well in that role specifically. Yeah. I thought that Chester Morris was adequate. You know, yeah. And that's nothing bad. But I think it's just in a movie where... In a style of movie where you really need to be like making a splash, I felt like no one really was doing that except for Regis Toomey. I thought Regis Toomey was kind of like the y'all mind if I go a little ham on this one.
Right, right. As far as the best moment for Chester Morris, I think that other than, again, these are scenes that aren't super exciting because of our year 2025, but his gangster dialogue and monologues and things towards the end of the film when they've got him in a room and they're like, okay, this is it, you're done, and he's kind of panicking and freaking out and begging for his life. That's definitely a highlight for me of his performance.
That is for me too, because you're watching the entire time, you're watching him being cold and calculated and in control. So one of my favorite reveals is that when you find someone, this is the difference of Nick Scarsi, right? Like Nick Scarsi in The Racket, when he was not in control, he was just kind of like, all right, you know what? I guess I'll just get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And like makes a plan to get out of there. But this time, when Chick is cornered and told, well, hey, you have nowhere left to go, you start seeing like an actual like weasel.
Yes.
Like he starts like weaseling around of like, well, how can I get out of here and what can I do? And can I use her to my advantage? And like, can I like get other people hurt in order to do this? Like you see him just thinking of like, he's in desperation mode.
Right.
And that's something you haven't seen from him before. So I thought that was great because it was completely like the 180 of how he's playing this guy. But it shows, it doesn't feel like, you know, I did it just to do it. It felt like, well, hey, this guy who likes to be in control and of everything, he needs that. Because without that, he's flailing.
Right.
So I loved that scene.
Yeah, it's cool too because you have Chick with Joan at the beginning where he's genuinely a nice guy, so he seems. Then you have his gangster version, and then you've got he is a scared animal backed into a corner.
Yep, 100%.
So it is impressive, his performance and the amount of different feelings he's able to evoke in the audience. It's just, again, interesting. Regis Toomey in this movie not getting nominated. But I don't think that there was a best supporting category yet.
Not to that point. And I think that they recognized that enough actors were doing that, where it's like, hey, maybe you weren't lead, but you were really doing your best work there. And that's when supporting came to be.
Yeah.
You know, I also just realized that the Cars character, who I was thinking of, is named Chick Hicks.
Oh.
So.
That definitely skews it Southern.
Yeah, it skews it very Southern for me. Just not, don't hear of many Chick names in Chicago.
No.
So, I agree with you. I think that he does do a really good job, and it specifically that ending is my favorite, or that ending sequence is my favorite scene of Chick, of him just like desperation mode. You nailed it, like just animalistic, like just survival. Like, how do I get out of this?
Yeah.
And not even like him thinking to himself. He's almost thinking out loud of just like reaching for things, and like his body is just moving in different directions.
Yep.
So, and I love how you can kind of follow his eyes to see the light switch and like know as soon as someone's distracted, I can hit that light switch. And I think that sequence that's filmed in the dark is incredible as well, because it could have just been gunshot noises, like pitch black, and you have to assume what's happening, but you're watching it happen, and it's filmed by moonlight of like them trying to scour and like capture him and everything. He even throws a, I'm not sure what it is, he throws up like a pot or something out the window to break the glass. So they all start shooting out the window, which I thought was just classic 1920 cop.
That's an interesting moment too, though, as far as the character development of Joan, because I believe she's the one that tells them, oh, he's gone out the window. And she provides his escape, because they all go to shoot out the window. Am I wrong in that?
You are misremembering just a little bit. I thought she was going to do that, but at this point, she's seen his true character.
Sure.
So she's back on the side of, like, my dad was right. So he throws the pot at the window, and all the guys are like, okay, it's time to go. But as he throws the pot at the window, he goes out the door. And she said he went out the door.
Oh, okay.
So then they go after him and chase him up the staircase to the roof of the building. So she does kind of like... She does try to keep an eye on him, but it's just kind of happenstance where she notices that the door flies open and she's like, oh, he went out the door. So I thought the same thing, that she was going to like defend him, because she kind of spends the whole movie defending him.
Right, yeah.
But I think truly seeing him in that animalistic nature of like, what do I do? That's true colors.
Yeah.
And for her, I think that was like, you know, okay, I know where my allegiance lies here now.
Yeah, that definitely would have been a moment in modern version of this, where great character development for Joan of, oh, do I give him half a second to get away, or do I tell him they went out the window? Maybe I was reaching for that.
And inadvertently, she kind of does give him half a second.
Yeah.
Just because, like, again, they're shooting out the window. Again, I don't know who you think you're getting, but they're shooting out the window, and she's like, he's out the door. And they are like, oh, okay, cool. And, like, she inadvertently gives him, like, half a second.
But yeah.
Still. Which then leads to the scene that I was referring to earlier, where Chick is escaping, and he's running on top of the buildings, and he jumps from one building to the other. And we watch him jump from a building with a horizontal angle. And then as he jumps on that building, we now have a vertical angle of that same building. But now you see in between the building that buildings he's jumping between. Mm-hmm. And you see, you know, I think the entire time it's art. It is artwork in between. But as he lands on the second building, he loses his footing and then falls. And there's a slight cut. And then it's what must be a dummy just falling down that wall. And I thought that was a pretty dark scene. Like, we hadn't really seen a gruesome death like that depicted. Granted, of a character who deserved it, right? A criminal. But nonetheless, like, I thought that was a very, like, dark, unexpected scene that kind of was a nice bookend to the beginning of, like, you know, the emptiness of this room and, like, how alone you are there, and, like, how you're just, like, kind of, like, rank and file and the routine of you following this pattern. And then at the end, it's just you alone and just falling. So I thought that was a really nice bookend that movie did. So I'm growing more kind of it more fond of it the more that I discuss it and it's like cinematography. Mm-hmm. But it's really the beginning and the end that I think it really shines. And the middle to me just kind of is Regis Toomey's movie to me.
Right, yeah. And although he wasn't nominated, I do want to talk specifically about his performance towards the end of his character's performance, I guess. He has this big reveal where finally the gangsters are all on to him and they call him out. They're getting ready to execute him. And Chester Morris calls him a copper. And Regis Toomey has this great moment where he's still playing this drunk and just being real slick and sly about it.
As they all get closer to him.
Right. And as one person gets a little too close, he grabs him, swings him around, his gun goes off, steals his gun, and now he's pointing a gun at all the gangsters, just commanding them to all drop their guns. And his that shift, even though you'd seen him play like the straight cop character for a while now, that shift in his voice and everything, I was just like, man, he means business. This is cool.
Yep. He plays it so well, too, where like he just switches it immediately and just plays a different character. Yeah. It's so great. But it's ultimately Jones' involvement that is the end of his success there.
Oh, it wasn't Joan. It was just some other...
Oh, that was Daisy.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's where a girl comes in, May.
Yeah.
So she comes in, distracts him just ever so slightly, and Chick takes the shot from his jacket pocket.
Yes.
So... I agree. I think that he really was the appeal to me, Regis, to me, was so good in that role as Danny McGann. I wish I liked the Chick performance a bit more.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good, and Chester Morris did well, but I think you're just kind of being out-acted up until that final scene of just, okay, it's time to lose my mind, because now I'm not getting my way.
Yeah, which is good that after you lose Regis Toomey, you do have that to keep the movie going. And you know, the more I talked about Chester Morris's performance and the three different types of his character that he's playing, I'm like, oh, actually this was good. It really just needs a supporting actor category.
It does.
That's what we're boiling this down to.
That's what we're missing.
Can we talk about Toomey's death scene though?
Yeah, absolutely.
Was that, how did you feel about the length of it?
I thought that it was very reminiscent of Seventh Heaven. And how it felt like the lighting was trying to like tell you what was happening versus like you depicting it yourself.
Yeah.
He has this moment where he's just talking with two other individuals about like, you know, how he's going to miss people. I can't remember exactly what he's saying, but it's just a very long monologue that isn't really like filled with anything.
No.
And then he's just kind of slowly going out. The thing that I thought was interesting about it was, and maybe this is completely by accident, is that the whiteness in the faces of the two people that he's talking to, there's one on his left and one on his right, and then Tomy's in the center, the whiteness on them starts to dim, and it becomes a little more black. Mm. And I thought that that was signifying the idea of like him like kind of blacking out.
Yeah.
And like him like seeing the light in just himself, and like it's blacking out and the fading on him. And if it led to... basically a black circle around his face and then just like fading out or cutting to black, I'm totally a fan.
Yeah.
But because it didn't do that, and it might just be a technical error or just they half committed to the bit, it goes on way too long.
Yeah.
But it does feel to your point, they're like, we're losing the best guy in this movie right now. We need to act right now.
Yeah.
And hold on to him for as long as you can.
It does feel just a little too long.
Yeah.
Again, great performance, but I feel like he looks at the one guy and he's like, goodbye, Harry. And then you assume he dies.
Yeah.
And 20 seconds later, he looks to his right and he's like, goodbye, Jake.
It's almost the exact opposite of The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
When she's like, and you were there, and you. And you can kind of feel Toomey doing that a little bit here, where he's like, goodbye, chair.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, wrap it up, buddy.
Who else is here while I still can see anything? It's really funny. I found this interesting piece of trivia about Regis Toomey. He, for a long time, held the record for the longest on-screen kiss.
Really?
So I think that was just his goal. He was like, look, I'm a supporting character. I don't really play the leads. So when I get my opportunity, I am milking it for all it's worth.
My death scene is going to be great.
It was so long. This kiss was something like 3 minutes and 8 seconds.
he might beat it with his death scene.
It's a long time to be smooching and dying.
It's not very elaborate. That's a great album name, by the way. Smooching and dying. Watch out. So for me, I think it goes on very like too long.
Yeah,
that's obvious. Didn't really understand why. I think I was looking for the cinematography and art direction to come back.
Yeah.
So when I saw like the fading of their faces, I was like, oh, they're doing it. Is that what we're doing? And we're like, nah, just the camera's acting up. Sorry, man.
And I think it's them trying to pull in a lot of sympathy for this character and definitely make you feel really connected to him. And while he has been fun to watch, just the overall, I don't know, writing of movies from this era, I think you're limited to how much you can really connect to any particular character, unless you're really, really doing wonders, you know, in the script. So they're pulling for it, and they're like, Toomey's good enough to pull off the acting. Let's just go for it. For me, too long.
Too long. Not just for you. It's too long in general. I mean, so let's talk a little bit about something that we talked about with The Racket, and that was how this movie was received, right? So it was received pretty well. Like you mentioned, you know, the nominations came forth. Reviews were very positive for it. You know, the best gangster film, even by today's standards, fun to watch. So the censorship, though,
yeah,
is that this faced a very similar situation that The Racket did, where it was actually flagged by the Chicago Board of Censors, and they banned it, specifically citing its immorality, depravity, you know, the criminal nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was appeals to have that, you know, removed to where it wasn't a censor that could stop people from seeing it. And it wasn't until ultimately a judge by the name of Harry Fisher actually watched the movie. Crazy idea. Let's just watch the movie and see if this actually holds weight.
Right.
And Judge Harry Fisher did exactly that. And they determined that, you know, censorship is a form of tyranny at its best, is what he said, and abhorrent to the ideals of American people. And then an injunction was issued to remove that so then everyone could see this movie.
Yeah.
And I think that's smart because, you know, at least in The Racket, there is the idea of, like, corruption within the police force.
Right.
And with Alibi, it is quite literally just the criminality, right? And that the police force is ultimately good there. If anything, the police force was highlighted in an extremely positive way. So it's surprising that they would try and, like, keep the idea of crime out of Hollywood.
Yeah. I think it is because at least at some point in the movie, you are rooting for Chick. Until you see his true colors,
right.
That is. So it does kind of...
Well, I'd say you're rooting for Chick when you think he could be innocent.
Right, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you're not, like, rooting for the criminal. You're rooting for, like, the innocent man. And then when he reveals to you that he is the criminal, it's very obvious, okay, well, I actually don't care for that guy anymore. So it seems like the movie's morals are in the right place.
Sure.
Which is why it kind of feels like the Chicago board was just like, you know what? We were here last year. We saw what happened.
Yeah.
Let's not do it again.
Because it was Chicago, right?
Yes.
That had the issue with The Racket.
Correct.
So that might just be their thing.
Chicago, yeah.
At the time, yeah, they were like, they wouldn't have liked Mortal Kombat, probably. They probably had an issue with that.
Mm-hmm. Imagine, I mean, Boston can have some problems with that. That's okay. Boston has plenty of movies where things like that happen.
Yeah.
The town especially, yeah, I'd hate to see that.
Right.
Interesting. Interesting that it's happening, and interesting that even in 1929, I mean, 1927 as well with The Racket, that it was happening at that point in time where censorship was still very much a thing.
Yeah.
So interesting to see pre-code censorship.
Yes.
And then see what happens once code becomes code, so to speak.
Yeah.
And becomes a standard, if those censorships tend to stay, or how many more censorships we're going to see before the code is enacted.
Have you ever looked at the commandments, if you will, the don'ts of the Hollywood Code?
I haven't.
So that's what's interesting to me. We talk about, you know, the cops are shown in a good light, a positive light in this, and it's mostly just the criminals that are the problem. Why would they want to censor this? But if you look at the don'ts of the Hollywood Code and what it eventually became to be, it's really just like any involvement of these particular things is a problem. So to run through them real quick, you had profanity, suggestive nudity, illegal traffic in drugs, any inference of sex perversion, white slavery, miscegenation, sex hygiene and venereal disease. That's very specific.
Okay.
Scenes of actual childbirth, sexualization of children, ridicule of the clergy, and willful offense to any nation, race, or creed. But you did have a lot of be carefuls, and some of that just involved, like, robbery, theft, criminal intent, and all of that. So you had, like, your hard, hey, you can't do any of this. And I think some of that pops up in things like A Broadway Melody, when we're talking about, quote-unquote, the scantily clad leads. But even in this, the illegal traffic in drugs, while that's not exactly what happens in this movie, I did see someone mention that early on you see one of the gangsters, it's implied that he's smoking marijuana.
Okay.
Because it was legal at the time. So there is that, but they're stealing coats, like we said. That's theft. eventually you get to the Hollywood Code that doesn't allow any of that. Even if it's showing the bad guy doing it, you can't show it on screen. So those reasons kind of allow you to make sense of why is Chicago coming after this when they're making the good guys good and the bad guys bad.
Feels like we need to be putting a little bit more focus and importance on other things at that time.
Totally.
That's just me. Do you know, have you seen the second? I mean, let's take a second to talk about the poster here. So we talked about the poster. I've actually, if you follow our Instagram, I did put the poster of Alibi on there for the announcement of our, you know, schedule to come. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure on this episode we'll include the probably this poster as well, if not a better one.
Right.
It looks like a Mellow Mushroom order.
Wow, that's so accurate.
Like, it just, the colors are just like, the colors are very vibrant. They're very neon. They are, the font is extremely large and inflated. And it just feels like you're ordering like a Maui Wowie instead of like, you know, watching a crime film.
That's so good.
So that's one poster. There's a second poster that I wanted to talk to you about, though.
Okay.
And there's a poster that almost looks like maybe it was used for like a consideration of the Academy Awards, right?
Okay.
And it has a cast photo at the top, and then at the bottom it has text. And the text says, "Get prepared for the greatest Alibi," in quotation marks, "in the world." And I want to, I just want to get your reaction real quick in real time as I say the second part. The perfect 100% talking, dancing, thrilling, gripping melodrama.
Okay.
And there's two words there that don't really stand out to me. And I'm interested if you caught on. I think you did, because I saw your face on one of them.
Right. I'm assuming dancing.
Dancing is another one. Uh-huh. There is technically dancing.
Sure.
But it is not a musical. It's not that kind of dancing.
Yeah.
It's very much like The Godfather. To be like, oh, I love the dancing in The Godfather.
And it's just everyone's like a wedding scene at the beginning. Like,
they danced at a wedding. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
And very similar to that. Perfect might be another word that I'm, you know, oh, interesting.
Yeah.
But 100% talking, that is true. Thrilling, gripping, melodrama, I give it that. Mm-hmm. For sure. But dancing, I just read that. I was like,
yeah, they're really pulling everything out of this movie.
I think you're trying to get everyone in here, yeah. Instead of saying romance, you kind of got all the parties.
Yeah.
So, interesting way that it's being advertised, whether now, much after its release, or at the time. Interesting posters. Look up the poster if you can. It's a fun watch.
Yeah. I think we're highlighting the poster specifically because, obviously, this will be way in the past at this point, but as we're recording this, Drew Struzan has passed away, who famously has provided the world with countless incredible film posters.
Probably the best in the world.
Yes. This movie's poster is not one of those. It really is kind of like an abomination, if we're being honest.
It is.
You mentioned it. Sorry. Chester Morris's face in the poster is rough.
It literally looks like maybe someone was choking him at the time and they kept their hand in.
Yeah.
And it's just like his face is not that big. It's very strange. And it's almost indicative of like what Hitchcock tried to do with his posters later on.
Sure.
But yeah. This is pre-Hitchcock. So it's like not really like, I don't know what it's going for. And to your point, I think posters like this are exactly why there's artists like Drew Struzan that can mm-hmm. come in and really look at a movie and say, okay, how can I capture this while also doing my own style?
Right.
I personally have two Struzans in my basement, and we're going to keep the Muppet talk going. I have Muppet's Christmas Carol and Muppet's Treasure Island.
Okay, nice.
I have those two in my basement, and I'd love to get more of his. I think his Blade Runner is phenomenal. Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. Star Wars. I mean, obviously he's a big one, but he did do Star Wars, correct?
I believe so.
I think he did.
It definitely looks like he did.
Let me know if we got that wrong, folks. But the other ones I'm 100% sure of, and it's just it's art style that it hasn't been replicated.
Yeah.
They've tried and they can't get close just because it is so uniquely him. So very cool and very appropriate that we take some time to dedicate, you know, some space to him because he was a very, very big part, still is a very big part of movies. And Back to the Future is another one he's done. So just incredible work. And he's going to be missed for the work that he did. And all the more reason that we go out there and continue to try doing art, everyone.
Oh, yes.
We need more Struzans in the world.
Yes. We need excellent, excellent movie posters to bring people to the theaters. Alibi actually kind of has like an AI look to it, if I'm being honest.
Which is weird because it's all over like the promotion of this, mm-hmm. like from what I've looked up. So if they are using that AI format behind it, that's just weird. It feels like whoever made that poster definitely did not watch the movie.
Yeah. It's definitely not AI.
Or know when it was set. It doesn't even...
Right.
Doesn't even look like it was set at the right time. Like, they're like, yeah, this was like a 70s romp, right? Sure, I got you. We're like, it came out in 1929.
Surprise. Couple things. We're approaching the end of this episode, I think. Roland West, the director, there's a little bit of controversy I wanted to bring up with him.
Oh, yeah.
So, he has long been considered a suspect in, like, this murder conspiracy of Thelma Todd. He was having an affair with Thelma Todd, and she was found dead in her car. Man, I want to say it was in his garage.
Mm.
Let me double check that.
It was inside the garage of Jewel Carmen, okay. Roland West's wife at the time.
Yes. Okay, that's what it is. So I think that's the first big controversy of anybody that we've experienced through the show yet. He also had a yacht. And after he passed away, this yacht, like, mysteriously, everybody on it vanished, and the yacht was just discovered
like
floating
out in
the ocean.
Like a Bermuda Triangle type situation? Or?
Sort of. It's apparently, there's a documentary on it that I really want to check out, because it's called The Joyita, and it sounds spooky. This has nothing to do with the movie at all, but...
Well, it's interesting, because, like, you know, it looks like it was something that there was just, you know... accusations, maybe allegations, like assumptions, but no proof that came out that tied Roland specifically to this murder.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't enough to incarcerate him or, you know, get him found guilty of it. But it was enough within Hollywood, obviously being in the public eye, to stop him from being more involved in projects in the future.
Yes.
So still very interesting, scary thing to be involved in.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, obviously... don't know if he was guilty or what kind of person he was, so take out the morality of the situation. It is a shame that it affected the career of someone that provided movies like this, really. A phrase we didn't throw out yet is film noir.
Definitely.
This is very much an early example of film noir.
A lot of trench coats.
Yes, and just the shadows and everything. Mm-hmm. You don't have that like narration element of noir, but... just the visuals are so striking.
Well, you know, I think some movies would sometimes have the audience be in on it, but then have the characters not be in on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting to see how much of Alibi keeps the audience at bay and wants you to believe what the characters are believing right now. So there's that element of noir in the narration or lack thereof as well.
That's true. That's true. Beyond that, I mean, do you have anything else to say about Alibi?
Check out the poster, have a good laugh. Make sure you check out the YouTube playlist that Kyle is going to shout out here in a minute. So you can watch the YouTube clip or clip, the YouTube posting of this movie Alibi and, watch for the cinematography. If anything, watch for the cinematography of this, for the performances of Tomy and
Morris.
Thank you so much. They're doing great work on it.
Yeah.
I wish the movie was a bit more cohesive. Mm-hmm. Incoherent. I think there's some technical difficulties that kept me from really enjoying it, but I would recommend.
You think a restoration where the sound was updated would help aid your enjoyment in this movie?
Yeah, you know, we talked about this with like the AI element, like how much do we want to see these movies touched up? And I don't think I would want like, you know, an audio like accompaniment of like, hey, we actually had actors come in and say the lines they're supposed to say here. I think a closed captioning would be beneficial.
Sure.
So you keep the historical artifact of like, this is very much how it played back then. But also in order for you to like understand the movie, here's the closed captioning using the script.
Yeah.
I think that would be beneficial to me.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want like a remake or like an AI or, you know, even not AI, like an audio dub of it.
No, nothing like that. I was more thinking of like cleaning up the audio itself.
Oh, sure.
So that you could hear it clearly.
Totally.
But really, all this movie needs is, like you said, closed captions.
And that's it.
You'd be fine.
Otherwise, everything looks great.
Yeah. I have a lot of praise for this movie, more than I expected.
Yeah.
You're
going to love my rating.
You want to do ratings or do you want to do the double feature?
Let's do ratings and then double feature.
Sure.
So what did you rate this the first time and rate it the second time?
Oh, man. Let me pull up my rating from the first time I watched it. I feel like it was low. I gave it 2 stars the first time I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go crazy with this. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars.
You jumped up 3.
I did.
Well, the halves, but yeah.
Yeah. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
What was I thinking? It's the best looking movie I think we've watched, at least from like a creative standpoint. Best looking movie we've watched so far for the show. There's stuff going on here that outside of your Metropolis and your Nosferatu and things like that, that you weren't seeing really in the Academy showcase, but really in the States. You know, it's called German Expressionism for a reason. You're seeing that here, and it is pulling its weight and then some. So I really enjoy just watching this movie, even if the plot is like, yeah, it's fine.
I mean, you're right. You said this about the Broadway Melody, about how we gave the 2-sentence introduction. You're like, that's the movie.
Right.
This is kind of the movie, too. There's not too much going on beyond what we've already discussed. Look, I agree with everything that you said. It is the best-looking one that we've covered so far. The acting in those two performances specifically are great. I did give it a 2.
Oh.
And in our discussion, I feel like I'd want to take it up more to like a 2.5.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I feel like I'd probably want to swap Broadway Melody and just give that a 2 and give that half star to Alibi.
Sure.
So maybe closer to a 5, but I think I feel confident in giving it a little bit more credit than I did before, but still not loving it overall.
Yeah.
And I can rank that a little lower. I mean, I really did enjoy my time with in Old Arizona. So I feel a little bit better about giving that like a 3-star, despite its problematic nature.
Right.
But I think I'd want to give it about a 2.5 is how I'd feel comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. I think we'll talk more on the ceremony episode of how much we enjoyed each film.
Sure.
We'll get into that detail. But just from like a technical and like an artistic standpoint, this movie's really doing a lot for me personally.
I mean, you put technical in there and it's a 5-star.
Yeah.
So everything else it's everything else in the movie that detracts from that 5-star.
Sure. And I think that's where the nominations kind of nailed it.
Yeah.
We just need that best supporting actor for Regis Toomey.
We're coming for you, buddy.
We are.
We'll get you that win.
Yeah. In the year 2025. Almost 100 years later, we're going to recognize you. So let's talk double feature.
Yeah. You had some time to think about this.
I did. I had a lot of time. I needed a lot of time. I dropped the ball last episode, but I'm here this time to say that as I had picked my movie, I swapped.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with Primal Fear.
Great pick.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And I almost don't want to like talk about why, because I don't want to spoil that.
Sure. But another classic scenario of like who's in the right, who's in the wrong.
Yes. Yeah. That's it. I'm not going to go into any detail.
That's great.
Primal Fear.
That's a great pick. That's probably your most inspired pick so far.
Thanks, man.
So I'm going to swerve. For my pick of a double feature with the... I do want to do that. For my pick for the double feature of Alibi, I'm choosing a movie that matches the dark tone of this movie when it decides to be dark. Not just in its cinematography, but in its tones, in its theming, features really great performances. And it features an idea of, is this person really the person that I think I'm talking to? Can I fully trust this person? And do they want my best interests at heart? I'm going with David Fincher's Gone Girl.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Quite a different experience than this, but the idea of cinematography is always very heavy on David Fincher's mind.
Yes.
The use of light, the use of shadows, the use of dark tones, the idea of whether or not Rosamund Pike's character really has the best interest of Ben Affleck or anyone other than herself at heart. And what has Ben Affleck done to register any kind of betrayal that she may or may not have done is an interesting thing that pairs well with this.
Yes.
I think it also shows the true element of who people are versus what they try to show us, which is something that obviously Chick's character does a lot in this. So interesting themes that match each other pretty well.
Yeah. And I think Gone Girl is a good example of like diving into those themes and characters in a way that I think we both wish this movie did a little bit more.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's pretty face value in Alibi.
Yeah.
Whereas Gone Girl really does deep dive into that.
Mm-hmm.
So, great call out.
Awesome. I love both of those.
We should have some kind of like tally on Letterboxd of like these movies and their like double feature counterparts.
Yeah, we should.
To keep track of the ones that we double feature them with.
Yeah. We'll talk off mic on what would look best for that.
Interesting.
I think it'll be good. But yeah, that's all I've got for Alibi.
That's all I have for Alibi.
If you would like to write in and let us know your thoughts about Alibi or any of the other films that we cover on the podcast, shoot us an email at outaopodcast@gmail.com, and we'll read all of those on ceremony episodes. That's coming up here shortly. We've got one more film to talk about next episode. That's going to be the Hollywood Review of 1929. If you want to give us a follow on Patreon and you want to show support monetarily, financially, patreon.com/outaopodcast.
That is correct. And editor's note, if anyone knows this or knows me very well and is listening to this podcast episode, and about an hour ago, with some change, maybe 45 minutes, you may have heard us talking about a character named Chick, and you may have heard Kyle then refer to the term wide open spaces. And if you're thinking, I'm really surprised that Ryan didn't make a joke about the chicks and wide open spaces, know that it's been sitting in the chamber, and I've been waiting on that for 45 minutes, and I did think about it, so you did not beat me to it.
Perfect. There is that one person listening right now. They're that's like, yes!
Justification!
Finally!
And her name is Taylor, and I will see you at home.
Perfect. Okay, that's going to do it for this episode. As always, I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
And we'll
see you at the movies.